whole planet is fighting the coronavirus, but doctors warn, don't get tunnel vision. Remember last year's Ebola outbreak in Africa?
Everybody was focused on Ebola, but 2.5 times as many people died of measles than Ebola because people took their eye off that potential problem.
Also today, Germany began embracing renewable energy 20 years ago. Now 40% of its electricity is green.
A transition to clean energy is not something you do in a year or 10 years or even 15, 20 years. It is a generations-long process.
And Saudi Arabia plans to build the city of the future, a $500 billion investment. But people already on the land say Saudi security forces are playing hardball.
You have no option but to leave with accepting whatever we give you.
I'm Marco Werman. All that and more today here on The World. Here's where things stand today with the pandemic. Officials expect that there will be emergency clearance for usage of the drug remdesivir. A major study has found that it reduces recovery times of hospitalized patients with COVID-19. The worldwide death toll from the pandemic has now reached around 230,000. What's not known is the toll that other diseases are taking. Social distancing has paralyzed global vaccination efforts, and millions of children have become vulnerable to other life-threatening diseases. Seth Berkley is head of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance based in Geneva. Let's start with the basics, Seth. Who's most vulnerable right now and to what?
Well, of course, the challenge we have is that children in developing countries are vulnerable because they don't have good health systems. We've been working to strengthen those. But of course, in a circumstance like this, when they're getting advice for health workers to work on COVID and they're in partial lockdowns, that has led to a reduction in immunization coverage.
And if it isn't obvious yet, explain why you can't still run vaccine campaigns during a pandemic.
Well, the difference between routine immunization, where you come to a fixed facility and you can have health workers using PPE, you can have people sitting apart, and you can have some type of distancing, is very different from a campaign where you, in essence, are asking large numbers of people to come together to get mass vaccination. And so that type of activity has been stopped because of the risk of transmission as a recommendation in all countries. Of course, countries make their own decisions. Some are still doing it, but most have stopped it.
What are the most concerning diseases that are not being addressed with vaccines right now?
Well, the most important disease is measles, which is much more infectious than COVID. MRI, the Measles Rubella Initiative, basically said they thought 117 million children in 37 countries might miss out on receiving the measles vaccines. 24 countries have already stopped those campaigns, and more are likely to be postponed. So that's the one that keeps us worried the most. And of course, there already has been big increases in measles around the world. And so we're set up for a really severe epidemic if this lockdown stays on too long.
Yeah. Are you starting to envision the catch-up process? Like, how hard would it be for the world to kind of start vaccinating again and getting to all the people who've missed out?
Well, of course, the challenge with that is the lack of information systems that allow real-time information. Of course, we've had experiences doing these type of catch-ups. For example, in West Africa, post-Ebola, there was a huge destruction in the healthcare system, as well as a loss of many healthcare workers. We were able to go back in and do a wide area campaigns and bring population immunity back up. So it is possible to do it, but of course it's unprecedented to have it in this many countries at the same time. But to give an example, during the recent outbreak of Ebola in DRC, everybody was focused on Ebola, but 2.5 times as many people died of measles than Ebola because people took their eye off that potential problem.
Vaccines generally, as you know, were already the focus of a lot of misinformation and fake news. And it feels like that aspect of the challenges that vaccination programs face is sadly baked into public health right now. Are you feeling that?
Well, of course, in general, there's less problem with these types of issues in developing countries than in developed countries. Why? Because in developing countries, people still see these diseases. They realize how severe they are. And of course, nobody wants their children to get sick. One of the reasons we're able to have this vaccine hesitancy in developed countries is that the diseases have completely disappeared. And so people are complacent, and therefore they can can talk about side effects or it isn't organic or the other issues associated with it. My hope was that, you know, with this global outbreak, that people would have an unprecedented demand for vaccines and that we might reduce vaccine hesitancy. But of course, the rumors that have been flying around have been quite scary. And that not only relates to vaccines, it also relates to testing. So we'll have to see.
Seth Berkley, the head of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance based in Geneva. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
When families in low-income countries need money, here's one way they get it. A relative goes to a wealthier country to work, often gets a minimum wage job, then wires money back home. Think of Filipino construction workers in the Middle Eastern Gulf states or Mexican farm workers here in the U.S. Add up all those wages. Immigrants sent more than $500 billion last year back to their families in places like India, Mexico, and the Philippines. The pandemic and economic slowdown are now rupturing this pipeline of remittances. And as the world's immigration editor Monica Campbell reports, the impacts are huge.
Here in the garden, things feel hopeful.
This is tomatoes right here. Passion fruit over there. Right here somewhere.
Right there.
Here. Is it?
Everything is blooming and growing. This is where Sergio Armas spends his days since his work stopped. Before, he worked all the time.
I work a full-time and a part-time, two different jobs.
By day, Sergio managed a housekeeping business in San Francisco near his home in the Bay Area. At night, he served Italian seafood at a restaurant with views of the Golden Gate Bridge. He supported himself and his family thousands of miles away.
To help my family in my country, which is Nicaragua, I have my parents over there and I have to help them every single month.
$300 every month for food, electricity, and medicine. His dad is in his 80s. He's blind and has heart problems. His mom has a neuromuscular disease. She can't walk without getting winded. They need medicine.
I can do nothing right now. And I'm so worried about it. That's my main concern in this moment.
Sergio stopped wiring cash home 2 months ago. So have millions of others like him. Worldwide, remittances may fall a staggering 20% this year. That zaps billions of dollars from circulation, says Dali Bratta, a lead economist at the World Bank.
That is going to rupture an important lifeline to a large number of people.
How many people? Hundreds of millions will feel the financial hit in parts of India, Mexico, and the Philippines, and in smaller countries like Kyrgyzstan, South Sudan, Haiti, and in Central America. And people who receive cash from afar normally don't have a safety net.
People will not be able to compensate for it by just borrowing from some friends. They would have to cut their consumption of food and they would have to suffer.
For Sergio Armas in California, getting federal aid or unemployment benefits could help him keep his family in Nicaragua from suffering. But he can't access that help because he doesn't have a social security number. It also doesn't matter that he's married to a U.S. citizen. In fact, because the couple files their taxes together, they are both blocked from any federal relief. This angers Sergio's husband, Francisco Silva.
Because if you're paying taxes, if you are helping out the economy of this country, you should be okay to receive help. But blocking that, I think, is really discriminating.
California plans to help immigrants like Sergio, who was about 1 week away from getting his green card when the pandemic hit. Immigrant advocates are also trying to help. Angela Sembrano is with the National Day Labor Organizing Network. She says it's a mistake to deny certain immigrants relief.
This situation affects all of us. And if people do not see that connection, then we are in serious trouble.
Sergio calls his mom every day.
Hello. ¿Cómo estás, madre?
Aquí con calor, hijito.
She says it's hot in Nicaragua, nearly 100.
¿Y la situación qué tal allá?
Pues, ¿cómo quiere que le diga? El arroz está 17, 18 córdobas a la libra.
How are things? Sergio asks. What do you want me to tell you? His mom says. Prices are rising. Rice, beans, salt, sugar, all the more expensive. While they talk, Sergio shows me a picture of his mom. She's in a wooden rocking chair holding a damp washcloth to keep cool and to swat mosquitoes.
Besito.
After the call, Sergio takes a moment to compose himself.
It's really complicated. It's really hard for me. It's really hard to just think that I don't know what can happen with them. Expensive medicine, expensive everything over there.
As a stopgap to help his parents, Sergio's maxing out a credit card that he lets them use in Nicaragua. His husband is helping too, but now his job is looking shaky. On Fridays, Sergio now goes to a church down the street for a free lunch, and he's up most nights worrying.
It's like 4 a.m. and I cannot sleep, thinking about what can I do, what I will do tomorrow.
I ask Sergio where he finds solace, and he takes me out back.
All these flowers, these roses, I plant myself.
There's also these pink and purple petunias around a small lawn and a grill and a patio strung with those small light bulbs. Sergio shows me something he just finished building in one corner of the yard, an altar to the Virgin Mary. There's a portrait of her framed by white lattice and more flowers.
All this area we're covered with stones, little stones over there. I'm doing many things in the backyard to clear my mind a little bit.
At night, he visits the altar and prays. He told me, I watch the sky and say thank you for everything, good things and bad things. Sergio knows he's not alone. Nearly all of his friends are going through the same thing, which means so are all of the families connected to them in other parts of the world. For The World, Monica Campbell, Richmond, California.
When the National Hockey League hit pause on its season in early March, hockey fans were left in the lurch. No season, no team to skate around the ice showing off the Stanley Cup above their heads. If you know the NHL, you know the tradition. Of course, you need a champion, so a family in where else, Ontario, stepped in.
Good evening, hockey fans from coast to coast to coast. Welcome to Hockey Night in our basement.
That was Richard, who along with his wife Cheryl and their two sons, 11-year-old Keegan and 8-year-old Garnet, recently decided to pick up where the NHL left off, in their basement. The family set up a small hockey rink, minus the ice, and played five-minute two-on-two games, working bracket of 16 teams. They filmed the whole thing, did some clever editing, and boom, a whole new series on YouTube, Hockey Night in Our Basement, an ode to Hockey Night in Canada for the uninitiated. The basement version features highlights, color commentary, and player interviews.
We're here with Sid the Kid. Big victory tonight.
Yeah.
How you feeling?
Awesome.
Sid night. The Kid, as in Sidney Crosby, yeah. The star captain of the Pittsburgh Penguins. Hockey Night in Our Basement even comes with its own ads.
Toilet paper will make a great housewarming gift when we can visit.
Hockey Night in Our Basement came down to a final matchup between the Calgary Flames and the Toronto Maple Leafs. Calgary got to hoist Lord Stanley's Cup this year. Hey, it's their basement. They make the call. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. There's a new word in German, Energiewende. It means energy transition, the move away from oil and gas toward cleaner fuel sources. Germany gets the right to coin a new phrase when it's outpacing the rest of the world, moving to solar and wind power. Germany produces twice as much renewable energy than the U.S. as a percentage of its total output. So how did the Germans do it? That's what we're looking at in this week's Climate Solutions segment, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Germany's renewable energy sector has been booming for about 20 years now. Reporter Dan Guarino with Inside Climate News has spent the past year digging into how Germany did this. I ask Guarino why Germany has been so successful.
Government policy that created incentives for a dramatic build-out in renewables, coupled with mechanisms that local communities could get benefits from it. Groups of local investors in some village in Germany or cooperative energy companies could form.
You spoke to Craig Morris with the Renewable Energies Agency about this. Tell me about him and what you heard.
What Craig helped me to understand was how the grassroots support for starting the energy transition and the fact that local people and local groups could directly benefit from it was this essential part of why there was this popular consensus supporting these policies.
All right. Here's Craig Morris from the Renewable Energies Agency.
And I think if we focus the debate more on let's make our lives better, let's create healthier communities, if we just keep moving like that and the inspiration becomes not just climate benefits for the future, but making our communities better, then I think we will get the optimism that we need to go forward.
So, Dan, is that essentially what happened? Did the optimism kind of materialize?
The optimism definitely materialized, but in many places, the optimism could not be sustained. A transition to clean energy is not something you do in a year or 10 years or even 15, 20 years. It is a generations-long process. What Germany found was that they could do a whole bunch of incentives at the beginning, but as the policies changed, as a whole bunch of renewables got built, there was this kind of waning of enthusiasm because of continuing policy changes and also just because of this growing not in my backyard sentiment.
But the desire was still there for renewables, right? And today, I mean, Germany is, as we said, 50% renewables. So how did the future get kind of pulled back into focus for renewables?
Within the last year or so, we've seen some policy changes trying to kind of re-energize the energy transition. Part of that is trying to bring back buy-in in rural communities. That's where we have the land that can accommodate big solar arrays and wind farms. And this is something that an economist in Berlin, Karsten Neuhoff, spoke to me about.
All our projections show that wind and solar power will be the backbone of our economy. Therefore, contributing to their deployment and providing the space for this is something where everyone can contribute to our country.
So we might be scratching our heads imagining such a broad coalition of support for renewable energy in the U.S. like they have in Germany and the ambition to match and oil and gas industries, you've got to remember, so powerful here and climate is so polarized. What lessons from Germany do you think can give us hope here?
When you provide local buy-in and local benefits where most people can say they are personally benefiting in some way from the clean energy transition, then it is much easier to maintain a political consensus. If this is just a bunch of big developers doing gigantic projects with very little benefit on the local level, it's very difficult to do.
We heard from the German economist Karsten Neuhoff earlier. Now, you grew up in Iowa, and Karsten also happened to be an exchange student in your town in Iowa when you were in high school. You were in marching band together, which is just kind of remarkable. But having lived in the American heartland, was he encouraged when you met him in Germany that the U.S. might be able to make the kinds of changes Germany has already started to make?
His background from his time studying abroad in Iowa helped to show him that a lot of the concerns of someone in rural Germany and the rural U.S., they're not that different. You just need to make it real for people why it is that they are doing an energy transition and show people how they can benefit from it. And that's something that Karsten could see evidence of in Germany and in Iowa.
Reporter Dan Guarino with Inside Climate News, telling us about what he learned in Germany about the transition to renewable energy. Dan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
In other energy news, a report out today from the International Energy Agency in Paris says, as economies grind to a halt, the demand for oil and gas has plummeted. Author of the report, Brent Wanner, says they expect a 6% drop in energy use globally this year.
This would be the largest decline in the past 70 years. Only world wars, the Great Depression, and the Spanish flu have sent larger shockwaves through the energy world.
Wanner also predicts a drop in usage of traditional fossil fuels like coal and natural gas. On the flip side, they're expecting an increase in demand for renewable sources like wind and solar. I'm sorry, but working from home just is not the same. It's either too quiet or too many of the wrong noises. The World's Amanda McGowan has been considering some solutions.
At home, you can't hear people typing or gossiping or putting in their lunch orders at the sub shop down the street. And if you're nostalgic for that kind of thing, a website called I Miss the Office may help. It's basically an office noise generator. Click around their virtual workspace and you'll hear printers running, games of ping pong in a break room, and people whistling or chewing. It's the brainchild of a creative agency in Berlin called KIDS. Designer Fred Wordy worked on it.
We thought about all the things that we would miss when we were working from home. Sound seemed like an obvious one. They're like, we all listen to music at work. Why can't you also listen to like some office ambient sounds to keep you focused?
But if cafes are more your thing, the US-based website Coffitivity has been compiling the ambient sounds of coffee shops for years. On their site, you can stream the sounds of coffee houses in Paris or Brazil or Texas. Ah, one double espresso, please. Coffitivity points to a study from a few years ago that says a moderate level of ambient noise can actually make people more creative. But Fred Wordy from the Berlin agency KIDS says that during the coronavirus shutdown, projects like these are about much more than just productivity.
It's the humanness. All those sounds on the website have to be made by a human. None of them happen without a human turning on a fan or moving a chair or typing. So it reminds you that people could be around you, I suppose, when you're on your own at home.
Reporting from my very quiet home, I'm Amanda McGowan.
News headlines are up next. You're with the world. Venezuela has the largest oil reserves on Earth, but its people face a gas shortage. In Caracas, if you want to fill up, be prepared to wait.
They are day-long lines, practically.
Also, Saudi Arabia wants to build a gleaming new city of the future. One problem? The people who already live on the site. That's still ahead here on The World. Imagine a gleaming half-trillion-dollar city of the future rising from the desert. That's what Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is trying to build. The new city will be called NEOM, a project to attract tourists and money to the kingdom. But as the world's Shirin Jafari reports, the construction of NEOM has already sparked a backlash.
Here's how this Saudi city of the future is being marketed.
NEOM is the place of dream. It's where humanity will come together again to create a new future. Assalamu alaikum.
As a dreamy, cosmopolitan place where anybody who's anybody will want to invest and maybe even live there too. Residents will get around the seaside luxury resort in drone taxis and visit the state-of-the-art entertainment center. At least, that's the plan. As of right now, the stretch of land in northwestern Saudi Arabia, where the city is being constructed, is home to people like Abdul Rahim Al-Huwaiti. Saudi activists have described Huwaiti as an educated and peaceful man from the local Al-Huwaitat tribe. Its members have lived in that part of Saudi Arabia for hundreds of years. They claim to be descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, with tribal connections stretching into Jordan and Egypt. That's Huwaiti speaking in a video he posted recently. He complained about what he called the forced displacement of his tribe from the Red Sea region to make way for the construction of NEOM. Huwaiti said government officials offered to buy his land, but he told them he wasn't going anywhere. In this video, Huwaiti is recording on the roof of his house. He looks upset. "I don't want to leave," he says. "I want to stay in my home." There are two accounts of what happened next. Saudi activists say security forces raided Huwaiti's house, opened fire, and killed him. The Saudi government says Huwaiti was a wanted man, that he fired first, and that security forces responded in self-defense. Whatever the truth is, the young man is dead. Last week, Saudi officials returned Huwaiti's body to his family. They told them not to hold a funeral. But dozens of men showed up in the desert with their traditional white robes. They carried Huwaiti's body on their shoulders and cried.
They were shouting, "Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar," because they're upset. Or we say that when we protest on the streets. So they said that when they got his body. So that shows you how much they're angry.
Alia Abu Taya Al-Huwaiti belongs to the same tribe. She left Saudi Arabia in 2015 and lives in London now. The writer activist says people from the tribe sent her photos of Huwaiti's bullet-ridden home. She posted them on Twitter and called for the Saudi security services to be held accountable. But then Alia says she became a target.
I got a call, first of all, a call saying that they're going to pull me from here. Don't think you are safe because you're in London. We're going to throw acid on you. We're going to put bullet in your head. We're going to kidnap you. We're going to hit you by a car. Everything is terrifying, actually.
Alia says she's in touch with the police. She's moved several times now, but says she's still scared to go outside. Nabil Al-Nowayra is an independent Gulf States analyst based in Washington, D.C. He's been following the Huwaiti story and says there's one big reason why the tribe doesn't want this megacity built, and that's because NEOM is sure to open the door to Westerners.
Like having alcohol or women wearing maybe revealing clothes, it's not within the Saudi culture or the Saudi, you know, tradition.
Nowayra says the crown prince wants NEOM to be something like Dubai, but he has excluded and alienated the people who live on these lands. The death of Abdulrahim Al-Huwaiti, he says, sent a strong message to the tribe.
You have no option but to leave with accepting whatever we give you.
Adam Kugel is with the Human Rights Watch. He says the Saudi government has relocated residents in the past.
So I'm talking about specifically the Shia town of Awamiya. The old quarter was destroyed in 2017 to make way for new development. And in 2009 and 8-9, following one of the Houthi wars, the Saudis evicted a bunch of residents in the border area.
Kugel says he's now worried that the same thing is happening with this tribe.
I think there's every reason to be concerned about this because they just don't have a good track record. And there's also concern about it bubbling over into more violence.
Alia Abu Taya Al-Huwaiti, the Saudi woman living in London, says she's not going to back down. She has started a public shaming campaign against anyone investing in the NEOM project. The way she sees it, this glitzy megacity should not be built on the blood and bones of the people who live there. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Is it safe to go to the polls during a pandemic? Poland is grappling with this question right now. The opposition in Poland's parliament say next week's presidential election should be postponed because of a lockdown. But the right-wing ruling party, Law and Justice, is pushing for elections to continue with a catch. They want the vote to be held entirely by mail. Wojciech Probowski is the editor-in-chief of the Central European think tank and magazine Visegrad Insight in Poland. Wojciech, what does that mean for Poland to have an election entirely by postal ballot? Is it even possible?
Well, it's not possible according to current law. Elections set for 10th of May is not by mail. It is by regular vote. but logistically it's impossible. And currently, the parliament is still processing a law. So during electoral campaign period, there is an attempt to change the law that will make everyone vote by mail. And even that, of course, under pandemic circumstances, will not guarantee that lives will be saved. And to the contrary, we expect that the infections rate will go up. But even more worrisome for everyone, not only in Poland, but internationally, is that the democratic process is not there. To change the rules during the game is simply not what you do when you have a democratic election.
So why is the right-wing Law and Justice Party in Poland pushing for this and the elections to go ahead? I mean, if there are doubts about health, risk, and election fairness, why not just postpone?
Well, this particular government is known for pushing the boundaries, and they want to prove again that nothing is impossible for them. Many times they have, actually, by bending the law or breaking the law, constitution included, they have succeeded in pushing those boundaries and showing how much they can deliver. But this time, it seems more like a defensive strategy. The government is very much afraid that by losing presidential vote, if that gets postponed in a couple of months, when a normal electoral campaign would run, the government would be incapacitated because the president is the key to effective governance of the country. The president's office can effectively veto any law passed by the government in the parliament, and the parliament would need 60% of the seats to overrule such a veto.
So tell us more about the Law and Justice Party, or PIS, in Poland. How would you describe them?
So the PIS party is somewhere between Tory conservatives and Viktor Orban.
Viktor Orban, the prime minister of Hungary, who's pretty right-wing.
He's pretty right-wing, but at the same time, he's very much free market-oriented. And he pursues laws and undemocratic practices that are now being criticized as building sort of oligarchical state, a state of many informal dependencies rather than clear, crystal clear rule of law. The government in Poland links itself very much to the general view of the world and of Europe as governed by very hostile rules, in which the best way to do is to look inward rather to look for external multinational multilateral alliances like the European Union. It doesn't trust norms. It doesn't trust international standards that much.
Wojciech, how concerned are you about the effect of the coronavirus on the whole of the EU?
I'm very concerned. So we're talking about suspending parliamentary proceedings by Viktor Orban and ruling by decree indefinitely. There is no sunset clause on this. Or we see a deteriorating situation in how the law is created, how the law is written and enacted in Poland, which has been the issue for the last 5 years or so. So these processes were there, but under pandemic, they seem to accelerate. And at the same time, European Commission or international community is preoccupied with immediate crisis, health crisis, while such actions go unchecked or not quickly countered.
Wojciech Probolski is the editor-in-chief of the Central European think tank and magazine, Visegrad Insight. He's been speaking with us from Warsaw. Wojciech, thank you for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Venezuela has the world's largest oil reserves, but as Venezuela battles the coronavirus, it can't get enough gas to its gas stations. In the capital, Caracas, people start lining up around midnight to try and fill their tanks the next morning. As Mariana Zuniga reports from Caracas, it's making life even harder for a nation that's already been mired in severe economic collapse.
Dr. Arturo Martinez was one of hundreds of motorists waiting for gasoline in a miles-long line at a station in eastern Caracas. He arrived at 2 a.m., but 5 hours later, he wasn't even close to reaching the pumps. When Martinez woke up in his Honda Civic, his car was a mess. It looked like a small apartment.
Bueno, en este momento creo que poco desordenado.
We prepared ourselves to spend the night here to be able to refuel. We brought some food and pillows to be a little more comfortable while waiting.
Every day before dawn in Caracas, key workers like doctors line up for hours at the few gas stations that still have fuel. Venezuela is short on gas because its refineries have collapsed and the country can't import fuel due to U.S. sanctions.
Martinez says the shortages are limiting his ability to function as a doctor. His car is the only way he can get to work due to a lack of public transportation.
Bastante porque va a llegar el momento donde va a haber una incomodidad tan grande.
It's frustrating and sad. There will come a time when there will be such great discomfort that doctors will say, I'm not going to work. I'm not going because I have to suffer to get gasoline and I'm exposing myself to the virus while waiting in line.
Further back in line, Dr. Alejandro Rodriguez is also waiting for gas.
A la cola de la gasolina llegué a las 5 de la madrugada. 5 exactamente.
I arrived at 5 a.m. It's 9 a.m. I should be in the hospital right now. Fortunately, what we do as colleagues is that we cover somebody's shift when that person is in line for gas. This is what we do, but it shouldn't be like that.
The government has promised that doctors and hospital workers will have preferential access to fuel stations, but Rodriguez has found the solution to be less than useful.
En mi caso no ha sido así. Yo he tenido que hacer la cola de los médicos.
I've had to line up within a special queue for doctors, but it's still a line. They are day-long lines, practically. I don't know if ambulances get preference, but my car doesn't.
Just a few years ago, this scene would have been unimaginable. The country with the world's largest oil reserve running out of gas. Critics of President Nicolas Maduro blame the collapse on government corruption and mismanagement. The government blames U.S. sanctions. In Venezuela, filling a tank is basically free. Thanks to government subsidies, a full tank could cost less than a penny. But out of desperation, some people like Jesus Peña, who sell chicken at an open-air market, are now turning to the expensive black market for fuel.
Uno a dos dólares por litro.
I buy it in dollars, around $1 to $2 per liter.
That's really expensive. He needs gas to pick up and deliver his food. Venezuela has less than 500 reported cases of the coronavirus. The country imposed a nationwide lockdown in March when just a few cases were detected. And since then, Peña hasn't been able to fill his tank at a station due to long lines. So he gets creative.
No podemos traer a comida, ¿verdad? Uno, yo me vine sin gasolina.
Yesterday, my neighbor sold me 20 liters that he took out of his car. I paid $20 for it. The problem is going to get worse. I have more than one colleague who's not delivering anymore because they ran out of gasoline.
Even though Peña desperately needs the gas to keep his business going, he doesn't know how much longer he can keep paying the high prices.
De verdad que no sé. Mira, ¿dónde va el dólar? Tengo la gasolina para esta semana.
I have gasoline for this week. I don't know what will happen the next one. It's worrying. I'm really worried.
Back at the gas station, as the line advances, some drivers like Dr. Martinez push their cars rather than turning on the ignition. Anything to save just a little extra gas. This extra time in the car gives Martinez plenty of time to think, and he shares the theory with me. He thinks the government is now using the shortage to keep people under quarantine at home.
Podría hacerlo porque si tú limitas,
it could be a little bit of social control. If you limit gasoline, you'll limit the movement of many people who ride in cars. If you see it from that point of view, it could be a way of control. If there's no gasoline, then you don't leave home.
Just a theory, though. The line advances one more time, and it's time to push the car again. For the World, Mariana Zúñiga, Caracas.
Lebanon is starting to relax its medical emergency measures after nearly 2 months under lockdown. Lebanon has just 725 reported cases, but the U.S. State Department told Americans in Lebanon and in other countries to come home. Even so, some Americans decided to ride things out right where they are. Rebecca Collard has our story from Beirut.
When Cecilia Bluer opens up the window of her Beirut apartment these days and hears the birds chirping outside, the 64-year-old native of New York is reminded why she didn't jump on the first flight home as soon as the pandemic started.
Well, I wasn't going to go back because I was so afraid of what was waiting at the other end. So I decided to stay here.
What was waiting in New York? overcrowded hospitals, makeshift morgues, and shortages of personal protective equipment. Bluer says Lebanon, despite months of protests, a divided government, and a looming financial collapse, is actually handling the crisis better than the U.S. Bluer arrived in Lebanon in January to spend a few months studying Arabic and volunteering.
They understand that God throws curveballs. They understand that. They whip themselves into shape very, very quickly. America just thinks it's an exception to everything, and it's not.
And Bluer is not alone. Other Americans are looking at the U.S. from abroad and saying, for now, they're safer sitting tight.
My name is Dr. Madeline Azar-Cavanna, and I am a U.S.-trained physician. I've worked with preparing hospitals for infectious disease outbreaks.
Cavanna just happened to be in Lebanon visiting her brother when the pandemic hit. She was supposed to fly back to Boston in March, but she says by then it was already clear.
Lebanon was on this much sooner than the U.S. Starting about the 8th, you started seeing the restaurants close down, bars closing down, and eventually they took the whole situation much more seriously than I was hearing that was happening in the U.S. And so our curve flattened sooner than the U.S.
Lebanon declared a state of medical emergency in mid-March. Technically, people are not supposed to leave the house unless it's absolutely necessary. Curfew begins around sunset and security forces come out to enforce it. Everyone in the supermarket is wearing masks and gloves, customers and employees alike. You have your temperature checked before you can enter. When the American University of Beirut canceled classes in early March, Max Tamer Mahoney returned to his native Boston. But then he came back to Beirut and he decided to stay.
It seemed like things were pretty rapidly going downhill in the U.S., so I decided that it would be most likely better for me to just ride it out here.
Better is probably an understatement. Massachusetts has around the same population as Lebanon, but the U.S. state has around 60,000 COVID-19 infections and more than 3,000 deaths. Well, Lebanon has had just over 700 cases and about 24 deaths. Mahoney says the anti-science tone of the Trump administration is a big part of the problem.
If even a country such as Lebanon, which has been obviously in some of the most dire straits that it's ever been in its history, a so-called global superpower such as the U.S. is struggling in comparison to protect its people, is really, really a shame.
Mahoney says at first his friends and family in the U.S. tried to convince him to come home. Now he says he's worried about them rather than the other way around.
My mother just told me that she was unable to find chicken and toilet paper in our local supermarket.
Dr. Sasha Fahmy went in the opposite direction, deciding to return to New York City from Beirut.
So I returned to the U.S. Out of a sense of moral obligation.
Fahmy is a physician and medical researcher.
Since coming back, I have been taking care of patients hospitalized with severe COVID-19 illness.
Fahmy says it's hard to say for sure what's safer, New York or Beirut. But she says certain populations are going to suffer more than others in both places.
For people who are in a position of privilege in Lebanon, then certainly it might be safer. But I think that that's true for people who are in a position of privilege everywhere.
Lebanon is hosting about 1.5 million refugees from Syria. Some live in informal camps, others in overcrowded urban neighborhoods. On top of that, nearly 50% of the population here lives under the poverty line.
The ability to social distance in and of itself is a privilege. It is impossible to enforce social distancing in a refugee camp.
If the virus spreads through that segment of the population, it will be a catastrophe, Fahmy says. So far, that scenario seems to have been averted. But Fahmy points out that Lebanon is testing at a much lower rate than the U.S., meaning the numbers could be deceiving. Still, the health system in Lebanon appears to be keeping up with the outbreak. Every day, the television in the lobby of Cecile Bleuer's building in Beirut shows how the coronavirus is wreaking havoc in the U.S. Well, here, it's a different story.
There have been no shortages here of protective equipment. I mean, and any pharmacy has face masks and alcohol and, for heaven's sake, toilet paper. Everything is here. They're prepared.
And she says there's no good reason why the U.S. isn't prepared too. For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard in Beirut.
Tonight is the last night of April, and what a tough month it's been. An easy one to say goodbye to. Across Scandinavia, this final night of April is known as Valpurgis, a festival marking the end of winter and the beginning of spring. It's usually quite a party. Take last year's celebration in Lund, Sweden. Singing, drinking, playing music around a huge bonfire. But this year, city officials in Lund are being party poopers. And I mean that literally, because to stop people from gathering in large groups, the city has spread more than a ton of chicken manure across its main park. The manure is for a good reason, of course. Officials hope the odor alone will make the 30,000 expected festival goers say, "Smell you later," leaving them the only option of staying home and not risk spreading the coronavirus. Lund City Council shared a video of a truck spreading the manure. They say it will eventually help people enjoy really green and fine spring and summer days. Chicken poop is a great fertilizer. There is no government-imposed lockdown in Sweden. Shops, gyms, and restaurants have stayed open, though many people have taken to voluntary social distancing, which is how they'll carry on with tonight's Valpurgis festivities. A local radio show invited listeners to send in clips of themselves singing the festival song, which loosely translates to "The Winter is Falling." The mayor of Lund told a local paper that overall people have reacted positively to what could have been a sticky situation. From the Nana Bill Harris studio, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.